a lot of guys go into entrepreneurship.
Okay.
Because the SEAL community, I think the special operations communities at large throughout the military breeds an entrepreneurial spirit. Just, you have a ton of autonomy to make mm-hmm. decisions within your small unit. You have left and right limits, but within that, you have a lot of autonomy to make decisions.
Yeah.
And through that, you gain a lot of experience operating in the gray zone and trying to figure things out
mm-hmm.
and being good at leading.
Yeah.
That naturally lends itself to entrepreneurship.
This is the Made to Advance podcast. I'm your host, Brian Olick. We're here to inspire and equip you for your best future. Well, welcome everybody. It is so good to be with you. And hey, before we get started today, I want to ask you a favor. I ask this, I think, every single episode, but I'm going to ask again. If you're a fan of Made to Advance, please rate and review us. I know you're listening right now and you're like, this isn't a great time. All you have to do is hit pause, jump on there, and click the rate or review button. But that really, really does help Made to Advance get a little bit more exposure, get out to more people, and make a greater difference. So please help us out, bring some encouragement that way. And then also, I've been sharing this lately. We've got an email, mta@engedichurch.com, mta@engedichurch.com. And so if you've got any feedback for us, questions, guest ideas, you name it, email me. Love to hear those. If you've got any encouragement, I'll share that with our team. We would absolutely delight to hear from you. But today, I have my friend with me, Kevin Rodrigo, who served as a Navy SEAL for 14 years and now is the co-founder of an investment firm called Starfield Front. Kevin is married and has four very cute kids, which I can say because I get to see them most every Sunday at church. I've really been looking forward to this conversation with Kevin. I know you are going to enjoy it. And so, Kevin, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Brian.
So good to have you. I know that I kind of shared a little bit about the podcast right when we actually first met, but yes. I didn't know if it ended up, you know, sometimes, you know, materializes, sometimes something doesn't, but
this is great.
I was thinking about, you guys had a ton of years, we'll get into career and all this stuff later, but a ton of years in San Diego weather, which is known by everybody to be like, this is the perfect weather. It's almost always 70s,
yes.
Plus or minus. And it's just comfortable. And then you chose to move to West Michigan, and and you got a pretty good snow for. I mean, this has been a pretty good winter So I'm. I mean, as far as a taste of, sometimes people move here and they're like, "Oh, that's not so bad." And then the next winter hits, and they're like, "Oh." So I am dying to hear, what's the transition from warmer climates to West Michigan like?
Yeah, great question. So my wife, Aubrey, grew up in Hudsonville area.
Yeah.
So she's very used to it, although she moved away to San Diego after college as well. But it's been a lot of fun. Our kids absolutely love it.
Do they? Okay.
And the sledding, we haven't done cross-country skiing yet, but we talk about it a lot. And we've been going to Mulligan's Hollow as well. So it's been... just the outdoor culture in general has been really enjoyable and fun.
Have you guys tried snowshoeing yet?
Yes, once.
Okay.
So we don't have the kids on snowshoes yet.
Okay.
But I've done it once with a few friends.
Okay. I've never done it, so I'm asking out of a total position of ignorance. But I hear people get fired up about snowshoeing. So having done it once, I take it you've only done it once, which means you must not have fallen in love with it, or you've not been around enough places you could do it regularly.
Yeah. So I think the snow has to be a certain depth.
Yeah.
And we'll get into my story, but through the SEAL teams, we did a decent amount of snowshoeing.
Oh, okay.
So like I have experience doing it, but just once here in Michigan.
Yeah, okay. Gotcha. Well, that's a good transition. Let's tell me a little bit about your background, just kind of like where you grew up, family background, all those things.
That sounds great. So I grew up in Pennsylvania, brother 7 years younger than me, and parents... incredibly loving, mirrored for me what a good marriage should look like. And they really prioritized sports and academics growing up. And I grew up Catholic.
Okay.
So practiced Catholicism until my young adult years. And with that, just with the way Catholicism is, the way that I grew up, we went to church on Sundays, prayed before meals.
Mm-hmm.
Pray before going to bed, but had no true understanding of a conversational intimacy with Jesus or a real relationship there. I didn't really understand what that meant until probably 23, 24 years old.
Okay. Wow. So quite a bit down the line.
Yeah. So college, Naval Academy time.
Yeah.
Still practiced Catholic and then moving out to San Diego. There's a few different things that happened all at the same time that really brought me to realize that there were certain things about the Catholic faith that didn't line up with what I believed. But I realized at that point that I had to love Jesus,
yeah,
and have the relationship with him. And then a few additional things that'll kind of play into my larger story. My parents did an incredible job of a ton of things growing up. And one of the things was they had this unspoken excellence in the house, which mm-hmm. played really well into achieving a lot in this world. But at the same time, there were negative things about that have played out in my adult life that I've had to kind of work through.
Okay. So that was kind of a culture. And your brother, I'm guessing, felt the same, that culture of excellence,
yes,
for him too. Yeah. What's he do now? Do you mind me asking?
Yeah. So he works in the biotech industry in Boston.
Okay. Gotcha. So probably a similar driven kind of a guy and whatnot. Now, how early did you know right away that you wanted to specifically head towards being a SEAL, or was it like, I just want to serve, like I want to be in one of the branches of the military, or how did that whole thing start?
Yeah. Good question. So, sophomore year in high school, I had a close friend of mine that I played soccer with, and he was going to the Naval Academy. He was a few years ahead of me, and made that decision a few years prior. And through conversations with him, realized that it could be a good option. And what I heard from him is camaraderie and a team atmosphere, mm-hmm. and those were things I loved throughout my sports career as a young kid. And so they offer a summer program at the Naval Academy, where you go for a few weeks. And I did that between my sophomore and junior year,
okay,
of high school, and I fell in love with it. I was all in at that point. I applied to other colleges, but mentally I was all into the Naval Academy.
Okay.
And I did end up getting in. And then throughout those 4 years at the Naval Academy, every summer, you don't have a normal summer like you do at a normal college. Out of the 3 months, two of those months you're off with the Navy, and you spend time with the surface fleet, submarines, aviation, Marine Corps, special operations community, and you kind of cycle through those. So mm-hmm. you get exposure to all the different branches of the Navy. And through that process between my freshman and sophomore years, realized through my time with some SEALs through that process, realized that was the right path for me.
What was it about your time with them that clicked?
Yeah. And talking to those guys, and this was 2007, 2008.
Yeah.
So they really were making a huge difference in Iraq and Afghanistan at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And being able to be a part of that shortly after graduation, I wanted to help make a difference for the country and lead in that way.
Okay.
Gotcha. And also like the same thing I mentioned earlier about the Naval Academy having the team atmosphere and a camaraderie. Mm. I wanted that,
yeah,
with my future career.
Did they're obviously the SEALs are about as high as it gets. Did the whole excellent side of things from growing up, did you sense just sort of a performance level that resonated with you too? Or was that not on your radar so much at that point, that sense of, wow, these guys are, the best of the best. And I click with that.
Yeah, totally. And it's interesting. As a result of having that unspoken part of excellence in my childhood, that led to doing hard things,
mm-hmm.
and being able to achieve hard things and go after them. But like, that doesn't mean my motives were pure.
Mm-hmm.
Like now that I've lived some life and I understand what a relationship with Jesus looks like major decisions were walking hand in hand with him.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't understand that then.
Yeah.
And in reality, I was making decisions there because I wanted to serve with the best. I wanted to be the best, but not necessarily for the right reasons.
Yeah. And we're going to come back to that theme. I don't know how exactly it works, but you express interest and then you obviously have to go through buds and the whole, yeah, process of, when you think about the journey of becoming a SEAL, but where it becomes official, buds is notoriously the thing that everybody says is the hardest thing. Was that, would you say on your journey, was that the toughest thing or not so much?
No.
Really?
I applied, you apply at the Naval Academy to get one of the 26 spots that were, and I think there's a few more now, but when I was going through, mm-hmm. there were 26 spots and I wasn't selected.
Okay.
And that was devastating. I spent 3 years training. Every day I was training for this, both from a physical and a mental standpoint. And really, looking back now, God was looking out for me. I was not mature enough at 22 years old to make it through BUDS. And he knew that. I needed some life under my belt. I needed some leadership experience under my belt in order to serve well, lead well. And that's ultimately what happened. I had to go to a ship. The way Naval Academy works, you rank out all the different areas that you want to go to in the Navy, first choice, second choice, and so on and so forth. And the only way that you can get a shot where we're applying to go to BUDS is if you go to a ship for a period of time. So I decided to go to a ship and was on a ship for ended up being 18 months, but 8 month deployment, and then ended up reapplying and got selected. But not getting selected, that was the hardest part.
How did you feel like you grew up in your time on the ship? What changed between then and, I mean, on the one hand, it's a decent amount of time that you were kind of waiting to reapply, but on the other hand, it's not that long. I mean, totally. So what changed in you?
Yeah, great question. So it's fascinating to talk through this because at 22 years old, no real leadership experiences under my belt, no knowledge of ship life or an engineering division or electrical division on a ship. They put you in charge of a 20-man division.
Right out of the gates.
And you have to lead and you have to figure it out. Yeah. And yet you have to show humility, ask the right questions, but you have to make decisions too. So through that process, you're forced to grow up quickly. And that's ultimately what ended up happening.
Yeah. When you reapply then, so then you're accepted, you start the process. Of course, anybody who's a little bit maybe familiar with the journey of BUDS, I mean, the way it gets depicted in movies and whatnot is there's the bell, like almost trying to get you to ring the bell. Were you ever tempted to ring the bell and say, you know what, I'm done? Or was it, you just motored?
If anybody that thought about ringing the bell once, generally did.
Interesting.
If you let your mind go there, it was almost like a parasite or a bug, and it's difficult to get out of your mind.
Do you know that? Because guys would say, like, I'm thinking about it, and then later you would see that it would play out, and you're like, yeah, they were talking about it, and here it is. So you basically saw, wow, that's so interesting.
And that's on occasion people would talk about that. A lot of times people would keep it to themselves, but then you talk to guys later. I had friends that didn't make it and things like that. So, generally speaking, if you thought about it, it was difficult to get out of your mind. I'm not saying that was everybody, but that was my experience.
When you think about going through such a demanding time, how much of it is physical and how much do you think it is mental getting through BUDS?
So there is a minimum amount of physical fitness that you have to be in order to make it through. It's probably on a curve then thereafter. But the better physical shape you're in, the weaker you can be mentally. Everyone has to be strong mentally, but you can be a little bit weaker than the next guy if you're stronger physically because your body can withstand more.
Gotcha. So hard to say, basically. It's sort of a varying, depending on how the wiring. Yeah, gotcha. So, you know, back to sort of the spiritual journey. So it wasn't like, it's not that your spiritual journey really started to shift right when you went to school. It really was once you started when you became part of the teams.
Exactly right.
What exactly happened? I mean, I know you said you started seeing some ways that the way you grew up maybe didn't align with what you were currently thinking and believing, but what was that process?
Yeah, so this was 2011. So it was right the exact time that I was transferring from the ship to go to BUDS.
Okay.
That's really when it started. And at that time, I met my wife, Aubrey, now. I was going to a CrossFit gym in San Diego and helped train for BUDS at the time. And I met three guys from there that invited me to their Bible study. And they're still some of my best friends in the world today. And I mentioned to you last week that I went to Lake Tahoe with them, these same guys.
Yeah, that's cool.
And then third, when I started BUDS, a few guys, there ended up being 10 to 15 of us that did a Bible study on Sunday nights to prepare our minds and hearts going into the training week.
Wow, that's really, really cool.
so through all three of those things happening at the same time, my wife Aubrey was very much a practicing Christian at the time, mm-hmm. understood what that relationship with Jesus looked like, and we had a lot of conversations about it earlier on in our relationship. And then and through the two Bible studies, it was the same conversations. And then the Bible study at Buds, what we did for about 6 months is just go through Old Testament heroes and their leadership journeys. And that's David, Solomon, and a few others. Mm-hmm. We talked through those, read the stories in the Bible about them. And, and then that kind of led into our leadership journeys too in the teams.
Did you see when you were seeing these other guys just kind of practice their faith, discuss it and all that, did you see right away these guys are relating to God, to Jesus differently than what you'd grown up? Was it evident right away? And oh. Yeah, okay.
100%.
How so?
I didn't know how to relate to him because I'd never seen that image before. Mm-hmm. And in seeing these guys that their parents imaged that to them, that it was, it was amazing to witness their walk, and that mm-hmm. definitely played into mine.
Yeah. It's really cool. It speaks to the power of, I mean, you know, sermons have a place, and good books have a place, and all these things, but just the power of making space in our lives for people of different spiritual backgrounds, or somebody that's kind of, I mean, you had a long Christian heritage in certain regards, but yes. It wasn't until you had that really incarnational, I'm with these guys, I'm hearing how they pray, I'm hearing how they talk, yes. that you realized, oh, there's something different here yeah. that I can step into. Did you kind of like, I mean, was your spiritual growth just, man, you just took off in a whole new way at that point, or was it this real slow steady, or how did that play out?
I would say it's slow and steady.
Okay.
I don't think it did not, it wasn't like a rocket ship or anything like that.
Yeah.
But when I look back, that was the pinpointed time where I began to realize what Christian faith is all about.
Yeah. Do you think you know, we've talked a little bit about how on teams, there are some guys that are obviously walking with Jesus and have a similar faith structure and conviction to you, and then there are guys who don't. And I'm just curious, when it comes to now how you follow Jesus, I feel like your background from a team's perspective could affect how you view what it means to follow Jesus. Do you feel like that happens or not really?
Yeah, good question. So I've been in a lot of third world countries as a result of the deployments that I've been on. So just seeing how Muslim countries specifically, mm-hmm. I did my whole career in the Middle East, most of my career in the Middle East. Mm-hmm. Seeing that the way that they live highlights the depravity of man, both from a standpoint of original sin and the choice to sin as a result of not understanding how they're supposed to live their lives. Mm-hmm. So seeing that overseas, made me start reflecting on my own sins and my own sin patterns, and realizing that like we're all sinful, and I can't do this on my own. Mm-hmm. Where for a long time, through my achievement orientation, I felt like I could control everything. Mm-hmm. But through that process and seeing the way that others were living overseas specifically, reflecting on my own journey, my own sin patterns, realizing that I need to be walking hand in hand with the Lord.
Yeah, that's interesting. So for you, a big way that serving in the way you did affected how you saw following Jesus is just being aware of your brokenness in a greater way. Yeah, that's interesting. Okay. Let's talk a little bit about just interesting steel stuff, because I suspect that people will be like, okay, man, he's seen some interesting things and done some interesting things, all that. So let me ask you this first for a little SEAL tutorial here. Getting to know you helped me understand just a little bit more that there are such a variety of things that SEALs do.
Yep.
And I think that the stereotype is if you watch SEAL Team, it's like door kicking. You know, I mean, that feels right. Like that's what SEALs do.
Yep.
And it's bigger than that. And so explain generally, and I know door kicking wasn't as much your thing. So explain what SEALs are doing and even what you did then, generally speaking.
Yep.
And I just think the people will find that fascinating.
That sounds great. I'll start a little macro and I'll work my way down a little bit. But so there's four distinct parts of different SEAL teams. And the first one is they do traditional deployments. So like I was speaking about earlier, the 24-month cycles, and you do individual training, you do platoon or troop training, then you do a kind of larger scale team training, and then you deploy for 6, 7, 8 months.
Mm-hmm.
And then the second part is SEAL teams that do almost majority intelligence collection.
Okay.
And they do intelligence collection for those SEAL deployments, and they also do intelligence collection for other things. And then the third is it's a small part of the community, but it's a really important part of the community, but it's diving operations. SEAL teams that prioritize just diving.
Mm-hmm.
But the reason it's a small part of the community is because it takes a long time to train for that, and it's very specialized. And then the fourth part are SEAL teams that execute missions that are on call. So I think you hear something going on overseas, and they deploy in a hurry. But there's so much training that leads up mm-hmm. to that.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, to answer your question a little bit further. So what you see in TV shows or the movies, that's generally only like, I don't know, 2-5% of what SEALs get to do.
Okay.
Everything else is training mm-hmm. for that.
Mm-hmm.
It's time with family, recouping back home, because that's a very important part. If your family's not supportive of you, it's very difficult to be in the place mentally and emotionally to be able to execute appropriately.
Right. Which, by the way, I mean, that's just a great little piece on life in general, because I think similarly, I remember once a pastor friend of mine was, we were talking about the importance of building into marriages. And as much as we as a church might have a commitment to, we want to reach people who don't yet know Jesus, and we yes. want to make an impact around the world, it's going to be really hard to do that if people are struggling in their marriage or in their family, because that's just taking over the whole windshield. You know, that's all they can see is that problem. So, yes. you know, that's where marriage wholeness is such a big deal. I remember you saying the military and partially cut back or shortened length of service times
yes.
deployments because mental health, which is not directly yes. related to marriage, but again, that idea of self-health being such a big thing if you're going to perform and do important and big things. So,
yes.
okay, so you continue on though. You were saying here about yes. kind of, yeah, just the what you did and what SEALs do.
Yes. So 2-5% is spent doing the actual operations. That's,
mm-hmm.
that's total time-wise of what you do in the SEAL teams. The rest is training. And there's a lot of mission planning.
Mm-hmm.
And as an officer, that's your main role. So I did a ton of mission planning over the years.
Mm-hmm.
But mission planning, training, and family time and recouping for the next thing is really the rest of the 95 to 98%.
Yeah.
And then just to give you a sense, too, of the different type of operations, instead of just kind of giving generalities, the type of operations that, you know, the full spectrum, you can be doing traditional operations in a deployment for 6 to 8 months in Iraq and Afghanistan, where you're potentially kicking down doors and doing operations, but it's more you're based there
mm-hmm.
and you're doing it out of that country. You can be controlling aircraft and dropping bombs on the enemy. You could be planning an operation and executing to take down a ship that has components or weapons on it of some mm-hmm. sort. You can be doing a diving operation off of a nuclear submarine. And those are just some of the different things that different SEALs do. And of course, some of those are different specialties that you train for mm-hmm. years and years at a time.
Do you have anything looking back that you go, this was what I really enjoyed, either the kind of work or a specific experience that really sticks out to you as that is a great memory?
Yeah, the best one was probably, so I got the opportunity to, between moving, we lived in San Diego for 11 years and then Virginia Beach for the last four.
Mm-hmm.
But between those two locations, we were able to go to Hawaii as a family. And I was there for 4 months. And during that time, I learned to drive a mini submarine. And picture it, it's as big as the room that we're in.
Okay. So mini is not exactly small.
No.
But compared to a full sub.
That's right.
Is that what you're launching out of? Is a
that's right.
Yeah, okay, full size sub. So,
yes.
okay, which I can't, I mean, I've seen old subs that are like you can walk through them and
yes.
it's insane until you're actually there. This is so big.
It's huge.
Yeah. So anyway, okay, so you got to drive a mini sub.
Yes.
Or is that the, what's the right, not drive probably is not the right word.
Yeah.
That's what you say?
Yes. Okay. You got it. But learning that process of how to drive the for 3 months, and I've never driven anything in 3D before. I'm not a pilot. So the practice of moving left or right, front or back,
mm-hmm.
but then up or down and having to get ballast correct. And
that is crazy.
It takes a lot of skill. And
yeah.
I can say that I wasn't the best at it, but it was a lot of fun.
Yeah. And then when you're using the mini sub, is that, would you go to the coast of somewhere? Does a team then like swim out of the sub, or what's happening with the sub then?
Yeah. So the idea is that you launch these out of a larger submarine.
Yeah.
And then you take this with SEALs in it and you go and execute an operation and you come back.
Okay.
And that's the general profile.
So the person who drives it, are you, I mean, this is getting in the trenches, I understand, but are you kind of like, you're parked, guys get out,
yes.
they go do their thing and then come back and swim in and then you get them on and then you're like,
yes.
Yeah, drive away.
you nailed it.
Gotcha.
And the water gets cold. You can stay in this thing for up to 6 to 10 hours.
Oh, is that right?
So it's and think about being in even 70 or 75 degree water temperature for that long of a time. It can be cold.
Yeah. Wow. What an experience. Yeah. Just a wild thing. Yeah. So one of the things that a lot of times people will talk about when it comes to just SEAL life, and you know all these books that have been written about leadership and whatnot. And part of the reason why I think that people like to talk about leadership relative to SEAL teams is because there is such a culture of we need to produce people who are leaders and who are not just needing to be told what to do when they're out doing their thing. So I think it would be fun to talk a little bit about what you've picked up on leadership through the whole SEAL experience.
Okay. Yeah, that sounds great. And I think what probably makes the most sense with that is just to talk through. So I'm big on frameworks. I think it helps just put things in the right place in my mind. And just talk through, it's a common, in order to talk about leadership, we have to have a common understanding of what leadership is and a definition surrounding it. So I think what makes sense is just, I talk to that a little bit and just talk through the framework and we can take it from there.
Sure.
So the way that I view leadership is, leadership is influence, and influence is leadership. And you can't have leadership without trust. And trust is the center point or the bedrock in leadership, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm.
And you have trust in three separate ways, and you build it in three separate ways. It's up is the first one, and if you're an executive or a CEO, you're still going to have a board or shareholders that you report to, and yet you have to build trust with them.
Yeah.
If you're middle management, you have senior level leadership that you're going to build trust with. And then the second is you have to build trust laterally. You have to build trust with your peers. If you don't, then it potentially could torpedo your. If you're very good up and you're very good down, and you're not good laterally. It's natural that it's just not going to be a good fit for you in that company or the organization that you're in. And then the third is down. You have to build trust with the people that work for you. But how do you build trust?
Right.
And you build trust in three separate ways: in character, competence, and mindset. And character, synonymous with it can be synonymous with integrity, motives, things like that. A few leaders in the teams mentioned this to me over the years, and it holds true for me, that when you think of integrity, everyone always says, definition of that is do the right thing when nobody's looking.
Mm-hmm.
But for me, what I struggle with is doing the right thing when everybody's looking.
Why is that?
We talked earlier about my achievement orientation growing up. The way that has played out in my adult life is that I tend to be people pleasing because I recognize that is the fastest way to achieve something.
Mm-hmm.
And that's subconscious. That's not a conscious thought. But if people are watching me, it's natural that there's these external pressures on me, that my subconscious mind wants to people please. So it's difficult to choose the right decision for the right decision's sake versus thinking about all these external pressures.
Yeah, that makes sense. So uniquely being around people from the standpoint of when it comes to having strong character and all that, uniquely the pressure of people being around is what would mentally persuade you to start thinking thoughts that you might not want to think and why. Okay, that makes a lot of sense. Yeah.
That's exactly right. And a lot of times when making these decisions in the SEAL teams, the ones that when everyone was looking, it might be your peers that are watching. And that's when it becomes very difficult because you might make the right decision and you're losing trust with your peers because they want you to go a different direction.
Right.
Or you're losing trust with people that work for you, but you're gaining trust from your superiors. So managing all that.
Yeah. Well, did you have to at times make some decisions that somebody on your team was like, this is just the dumbest thing I've ever seen. And you had to know just in your heart, I am making the right call.
Yes, definitely. I'm trying to think of an example.
did it work out? I mean, yeah, it might not be able to without a specific example in mind. Sometimes you make the right call and after everything is said and done, everybody sees, that was the right call.
Yeah.
And then other times you make the right call and the people that disagreed with you on the front end still think, I would not have made that call. Did you, as a gut read, did it work out for you? Were they people usually saw the wisdom of your approach on the backside, or was it like, no, the same people who thought it was not ideal stayed in that place?
Yeah. So Brian, it's super interesting that it doesn't always work out that way. And there's always people within an organization, within a small team that you're working so closely together. They see all of the good things. They see all the flaws and the things that you do. There's always going to be people that disagree. But when I talk about character and then competence and under the competence category, you put how do you communicate?
Mm-hmm.
How do you build trust through that communication that falls into the competence category? And those people that you see that don't agree with it, that's just a conversation like this. You have to sit down with them and have that conversation and hear their side and listen to them and learn from them. And maybe you did miss something that they see that you don't.
Yeah, it's a really interesting thing. I mean, I think every leader and not just leaders feels this pressure of, I don't want to disappoint people. There is the rare person who just goes, I'm doing my thing and I, could give a rip on what anybody thinks. But most of us are not wired that way.
Yes.
And so making the hard call when you just, it's the right call, but it's the hard call is a really tough thing, but it's a really important attribute of a good leader.
Yes.
And it seems like I don't know how much this is popular conception, how much is real, but it feels like in the team structure, it feels like there's an atmosphere where it's pretty open to sharing, sharing your mind. It's not like the leader just says his thing and then everybody just gets in line and says, that's that. I mean, would you say there's a lot of like, if a guy has pushback, he's going to feel pretty free to give you the pushback? Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. And the teams, because I think it's a type of people that are within the organization.
Yeah.
Everyone tells how it is.
Yeah.
Regardless of your rank.
Yeah.
I mean, they speak their mind.
Yeah.
And after every operation, actual operation, after every training operation, after every training evolution, we're always doing after action reports.
Mm-hmm.
Sitting down like this as a group.
Yeah.
And having a truthful conversation about what Kevin messed up or what the next guy messed up so we can learn from it.
But that's such a good example. I mean, for all of us on what it looks like to have those conversations and they're not personal. I mean, would guys, sometimes they would be personal.
Totally. Yes. Yeah. Guys take it like that sometimes. And sometimes I did too. And
yeah.
It's hard.
Would you say guys delivered what they had to say in a good way? Or were sometimes, was it like, man, that's a jab. And you're making this, maybe you've got merit to your point, but the way you're saying it's definitely making it harder to hear than it needs to be. How did it go? Were people pretty good about how they said their feedback or was it more, you're just trying to roast me right now.
I mean, in those settings, everyone's pretty receptive.
Yeah.
it's just by the nature of it. We recognize when we're sitting down and having those conversations post-training, post-operation, that you have to be receptive because that's how we get better. And that's how you protect the guy next to you.
Yeah.
If you're not improving, then you're not you can potentially hurting yourself or the guy next to you.
Do you feel like, I don't know how much, I know a little bit about what you're doing now professionally, but post-teams, it feels like when you're serving with the teams, I mean, having candid conversations like that is an essential. Life is at stake, you got to. But then it feels like what I sometimes hear in corporate environments, both for-profit, non-profit, is everybody is, people are not quite as candid as maybe they ought to be at times. Yeah. Would you say your professional experience post-teams has been that same attitude and atmosphere of candor, and you're working with vets, so that helps.
That's right.
But I mean, or have you felt like that slips since not being in the team environment, candor?
I think TBD for me, Brian. I mean, my business partner now was is a close friend of mine that I went through Buds with. That was a part of that Bible study that we were going through Buds. So like, we very much know how to be candid with each other and know how each other operate.
Yeah.
We have all that trust from all those years built up. But what we're doing now is we're looking to buy companies in the national security sector or companies that embody American resilience. It doesn't necessarily mean that there's going to be veterans in that organization. So we intend to implement some of these after action like reports into these companies in order to ensure that we're improving on a daily basis.
Is that a welcome change for companies that they're not used to that, or is that have you had enough experience with it yet to see that, you know, see their reactions, and has it been a welcome change, or do you go, it's too early on that
It's too early, but we've had conversations with individuals within companies about that, and I think it's going to be depend on how it's implemented and the communication associated with that.
Yeah.
But the people that we talked to said that it's going to be a good change.
Yeah. I think it seems like for people who want to step up and really be part of something that's strong, making a difference, that's the kind of person that's going to really love candid conversations, feedback, how do I get better?
Yes.
And then there are some folks that really are just not wired for that same thing. And they're probably going to feel like maybe this isn't the place for
that's
me because it's uncomfortable, but
yes.
It's a good discomfort if you're willing to embrace it. And I can think all the times people have given me just good feedback that's been helpful for me becoming who I am. When you think about that group of guys that you were just back with for a week, well, first off, I'd be curious, what do you guys get together for a week? What do you do for a week? That was how long you were there, right? A week?
5 days.
5 days. What are you spending time doing for those 5 days?
It is a mixture of outdoor adventure and fun.
Okay.
Prayer time and fellowship, and then time in the Word. And it's a combination of all of the above. Some of it's just sitting and doing a puzzle and having a good conversation and catching up.
Yeah.
We see each other once a year. I mean, a lot of the guys have moved away from San Diego, so all of us come together once a year. And this year was a little different. There were just there were a few guys that were dealing with some really hard stuff, life stuff. So we spent many, many hours just talking through that hard stuff and putting our hands on them physically and praying over them and kind of taking turns and going down the line, each praying for that person.
Man, that's so good. I'm thinking about a lot of guys I know who are still hesitant to like really embrace community. Mm-hmm. And it's just so weird because you're talking and just based on sheer stereotypes alone, we're talking guys who are Navy SEALs, and I feel like it's fair to say there's some toughness there, there's some resilience there, and yet you guys are still making time to pray for each other, lay hands on each other, talk about hard things together, encourage each other. I don't know. What is the deal? Why do folks, I want to be like, okay, you know, if Kevin was doing it with his buddies, then I think the rest of us can say it'd probably be good for us too. What do you think is the hesitancy for guys to step into that kind of community?
Yeah, it's a good question. I'll say this. I mean, I've struggled with it at times.
Mm-hmm.
When we moved from San Diego, where we had this strong community, moved to Virginia Beach, where we knew some people. We had the military community, but we didn't have a strong Christian community. I mean, it takes putting yourself out there and overcoming some fear in order to meet guys or gals that you're gonna have lifelong friendships with. It takes putting yourself out there and be vulnerable and authentic, and that's not easy.
Yeah.
So my guess is fear, and I felt that in Virginia and didn't put myself out there in the way that I probably should have.
Yeah, so that's a good point. And I mean, and the whole idea of it's weird because on the one hand, it does take time and you have to be patient. You can't just move to a new place. I'm sure you guys are experiencing this a little bit. And in West Michigan here is I know you've met some great people, but at the end of the day, the kinds of relationship we're talking about, generally speaking, take time. But even with time, it's a decision, and it still takes courage. And no matter how many crazy things you've done, piloting a mini submarine off the coast of various countries, I mean, at the end of the day, opening up your heart is opening up your heart,
yes.
And that's a decision. That's really really cool that you got to experience that. What do you think that for you, the greatest gifts have been of being part of that community of guys over the years? What's that brought into your life?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, the immediate gift of 2011 of understanding what Christianity was truly all about. Love of God, love of people.
Yeah.
Understanding a relationship with Jesus. But then these 12 guys, I mean, probably a little bit more than that, I think 15 guys over the years, with a single phone call, I can talk to any one of them about anything that's going on in my life, and they'll be receptive, and they'll pick up every time.
Mm-hmm.
So that's
just huge support.
Huge support, and it doesn't make a difference. Now I've been apart from some of these guys for some of them a decade.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't matter.
Yeah.
It's because of the centeredness of our relationship with Jesus that has carried us forward.
Yeah. We just all need those kind of relationships too. That's the thing that sometimes I think that people will start thinking about, man, I wish I had that, when they're in the middle of a hard time and suddenly they lack that kind of support. And that can all of a sudden become a really lonely, really difficult position to be in.
Yeah.
And the trick here is being proactive about it and building into those kind of relationships in some ways before you need them.
Yeah.
And then when something hits, and the reality of life is something's going to hit, and then you've got the community already in place. Thinking about that whole proactive thing made me think about something else that you and Aubrey did that I thought was really cool. You realized, and you're going to maybe need to clarify the details, that early on, I think it was coming back from deployments, that adjustment, and that's for military families, that's famously like a really hard time.
Yes.
You guys had to be proactive on how you were going to prioritize your marriage and all that. Tell me what you did. Tell me how and why you realized this is not going the way we want it to, and then what you did and how did you come to that decision?
Yeah, great. No, so unfortunately, we realized it through errors, not doing it well. Coming back from these deployments, and our relationship took way longer than we would have liked to get back to a normal place and a place where we were loving each other well. And so through those mistakes, we realized that we needed to proactively schedule marital counseling coming back from these deployments, just to have a third party ask deeper questions and then be kind of an intermediary between the two of us. And especially when we started having kids, that's when we really needed it. We needed it more than ever.
And why was that?
Because it just adds another dynamic.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately for us, and I've talked to friends about this too, so some of my friends deal with it too, is that in marriage, when you have kids, sometimes it turns into a little bit more of a business relationship instead of a loving marriage.
Mm-hmm.
And we felt that too
at
the time. And Brian, what's interesting is that deployments are hard, but training's harder. Our training over the years, you're gone for a period for 2 weeks to a month at a time. You're coming back for a week or a few days, and then you're gone again.
Wow!
So you're trying to integrate constantly back into
that's
life.
A tough rhythm. So you don't get settled, basically.
That's right.
Yeah.
And then naturally, I know that I'm supposed to be the leader of the household, but how can I do that when I'm coming and going so often? So Aubrey's taking care of the household. She's taking care of that while I'm gone. But then I'm coming back in, and it's natural that we're going to be butting heads, and that happened.
Right. Well, I love that you guys got intentional about figuring out a plan. I mean, on the one hand, one could say, well, sure, it was reactive in the sense that you know, you had a problem or a challenge you're facing and you realized you had to do something about it. But then you got into a rhythm where you said, hey, just in an ongoing fashion, we just need to adopt a new practice here. And I just think that says a ton about you guys to be mm-hmm. smart about this. And again, for anybody who's, you know, who's listening to us talk, it's funny because when it comes, generally speaking, when it comes to marriage counseling, I would say men are far more resistant than women. And so part of we're talking here and I want to be like, okay, everybody listening, we're talking with a guy who served with 14 years with the SEALs. You're in community with guys. You're getting real about life. You're going to marriage counseling. It's okay that we do these things. In fact, I think it's one of the manliest things we can do when we're willing to step into those vulnerable places and say, I am going to do whatever it takes to prioritize the most important relationships of my life. And so I just salute you, Kevin, for that. I'd love to talk a little bit more about, you know, we talked a little bit earlier about the culture of excellence you grew up with, achievement orientation.
Yeah.
And one of the things I think is really cool about your story is how you've been really sensitive to like the inner journey of what's going on inside you. What are your motivations? What needs to be, maybe fanned in flame more, but also what might need to die or need to be repented from. And so, so take me on that journey a little bit. I think it's been really, really cool to hear you just talk about looking deep on the inside.
Yeah. Thanks for asking, Brian. And largely, this is still something I'm working through.
Mm-hmm.
So I'll just talk through it, but it's something that I'm struggling with and still trying to work through with the Lord. So, I mentioned kind of the undercurrent of excellence in the household growing up, and there's really good things about it, and then there's stuff that I'm still working through in that. So the gifts of that, it gave me the confidence over time to go after anything.
Mm-hmm.
And despite that, despite something being hard, and then having the focus and work rate and work ethic to be able to accomplish that goal, so that that was the gift that came from it. But at the same time, the other side is the curse, and the curse is I constantly have to be doing.
Mm.
I constantly have to be looking to the next thing in order to feel fulfilled.
Yeah,
and. And subconsciously, my mind always goes to accomplishing the outcome versus enjoyment to the process. Where I'm constantly telling myself process over outcome, because I want to enjoy the process, but it's hard for me.
Yeah.
And the constant doing, it's very difficult to have a strong relationship with the Lord when I'm always looking toward the next thing. I can't be present.
Yeah.
So that's what I'm working.
Yeah,
I'm working through.
Yeah, how does that affect the idea of? And I think a lot of people will probably, to varying degrees, resonate with that. What sort of a feeling good about oneself by performance ultimately is what it is. Where your identity, you're like, hey, as long as I'm achieving, I'm performing, I'm busy, I'm doing something, I feel good. But it's interesting. I'm thinking about your marriage relationship, and would you say that you're good at just kind of being still in that relationship, or does it feel like we got to be doing something as a couple? Because I feel like sometimes our marriages actually end up teaching us about what it means to relate to God. So I'm curious how this is like intersected with your marriage.
Yeah, good question. So Aubrey naturally doesn't struggle with the same things that I do. And she very much has, I think in marriage in general, the things that we're different the things that we're naturally wired towards and we're different about, we tend to, if we're on opposite ends of the spectrum, we're going to come closer to the center.
Mm-hmm.
And that's very much the case here. Okay. Is that over the years, what we realized is that once the day is going, I'm going. Mm-hmm. And I'm constantly moving and doing. But we need to prioritize the mornings and sitting together, praying together, mm-hmm. And then just talking, catching up on life outside of logistics, which we don't always do that perfectly, but we know we need it.
Mm-hmm.
In order to have a relationship with the Lord, like we know we're called to, like, that's part of our life that we have to.
Is that hard for you to do, or have you gotten comfortable with that? We're slowing down and we're just being with right now.
It's taken time to get comfortable with it.
Okay.
I'm comfortable now. but it wasn't overnight that that became easy.
Mm-hmm. Gotcha. It'll be interesting to see, I guess, and sort of the direction of my questions goes. Sometimes I feel like, you know, you can get comfortable like with your spouse in that dynamic. And sometimes I still have to tell myself, because I love accomplishing things. And for me, it's not so much, I don't know if it's an identity thing, but I would say just the idea of moving, it feels good. I mean, I just like going.
Definitely.
And so I've had to really think about, man, when I'm with Christina, I just enjoy being with her, being in her presence. Yes. I don't have to work at it. It's just fun to not do anything.
Yes.
And so then sometimes I have to read that back into my relationship with God and say, man, what's it like to just be with Jesus? Yes. And it's not about, you know, what are we going to do, Jesus? What are you calling me to? That's my natural mentality. Where are we going? You know? So I sometimes try to apply those lessons sort of backwards from the relationship in my marriage to my relationship with God. What's it like when I think about you're doing such a weird, unique, amazing job for 14 years and I know everybody listening just feels so grateful for the many men and women who have sacrificed a lot and sacrificed at the personal level, the family level to serve our country. And so thank you for that, Kevin.
Yeah.
You then have to, after 14 years of doing a very unique, incredible job, then have to become a civilian where you're, you know, not doing all those things. I mean, yes. is that a tough transition, or is it more like, hey, I'm ready to have a break from team stuff all the time? What's that move like?
Incredibly difficult.
Is that right?
And every single guy that I talked to about this that are going through or going through it currently, it's hard.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard to figure out exactly what your new passion is. Like, most guys that went into the SEAL teams, I was on the shorter end, but I have friends that wanted to do this from 7 or 8 years old. They literally trained for it for almost 2 decades before they became a reality. My business partner, he decided that he was going to learn a language and become fluent in a language before he got accepted into the SEAL team. So like, that's years of preparation. So the idea of getting out of something that's been your dream for such a long time and transitioning into something that there's a lot of unknown there, it's difficult.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, I'm thankful that the military gave me the ability to transition out for 9 months while I was still paid by the government,
mm-hmm.
but I didn't have any military responsibilities. So during that time, I was by myself looking for a business to buy, and I was under contract twice during that time, but it just didn't, through the due diligence process, those two didn't end up working out.
Mm-hmm.
And when the most recent one ended up falling through, at that point, I was going to have to completely divert and do something and figure out something completely different, which was very, it felt like a failure.
Right.
But I only felt that for a very short amount of time because Latham, my business partner now, ended up calling me and saying, hey, I see what you're doing. Let's partner up and try to do this together.
What is there a trend when it comes to what SEALs do after? What's the typical retirement age? Just range wise, is there a typical retirement age?
Generally, guys will stay in 20 years. It's not, around 42.
Okay, and so young. I mean, when they're rolling out, they're young. Is there a trend or when it comes to what SEALs do next, or is it just all over the board?
A lot of guys go into entrepreneurship.
Okay,
because the SEAL community, I think the special operations communities at large throughout the military breeds an entrepreneurial spirit. Just you have a ton of autonomy to make mm-hmm. decisions within your small unit. You have left and right limits, but within that, you have a lot of autonomy to make decisions.
Yeah.
And through that, you gain a lot of experience operating in the gray zone and trying to figure things out
mm-hmm.
and being good and being good at leading.
Yeah.
That naturally lends itself to entrepreneurship.
Do guys come out again? Broadly speaking, I have no idea what SEALs get paid and whatnot. Are they coming out going, man, I've got to get something going fast for work? A lot of this is going to turn too on how they handle their finances while they were still serving. But are they like, we got to get to work? Yeah. Or is it such that guys are coming out with, they've got some financial margin to take some time? Or is there a trend there?
Yes. Most guys will start a job as soon as they get out to support their families. if it is a traditional job and not entrepreneurship, they end up switching jobs within a year or two.
Okay.
And that is the trend. And that's told to us as we're getting out, because there's a time pressure there, an external time pressure.
Yeah, makes sense. Man, that would be such a crazy journey. And I know I asked you this question, I think maybe the first time I met you, I think you said the hardest thing about making the transition was still the loss of the community. Would that be the case? Would that be the hardest pinch point when it comes to that transition?
It's community, but there's two specific things about community, and it's the team atmosphere, the camaraderie that comes with that, and then the competition that comes with that.
Uh-huh.
I mean, it's really fun to be in competition with if you're in a platoon, 20 guys at any given time.
Yeah, that makes sense. We had a breakfast for veterans, not long ago, and one of the guys told me it was one of the highest compliments. He wasn't a SEAL, but he was, and I forget what branch he served in. I think the Army, but he talked about the power of community and relationships he had when they served, and he and his wife both too, because obviously for spouses it can be really tight too, because those spouses are hanging tight,
yes,
because their husbands are out doing whatever,
yes.
And he said their current cable group here at church, he said, this is the closest thing I've ever experienced post serving to the level of community I had when I was serving. And he said, literally is almost at that place. And I thought, that is amazing to hear. I'm so grateful, because it's hard in, I'll call it normal life, to approximate. You guys are in a very special circumstance when you're serving. And so anyway, that was really cool.
It's amazing.
One of the things that you do that is neat is, as a way of giving back, is something called Life Camp USA.
Yes.
And I would love for you to just explain what that is and how you developed a heart for it.
Yeah, so one of the things that I was praying about getting out of the military was being in a position to have a job where I had a few hours a week to devote to a nonprofit or nonprofits that I'm passionate about.
Mm-hmm.
And I was exposed to Life Camp USA. Actually, through one of the SEAL organizations, introduced me to them. And what Life Camp does is it's mentorship through outdoor camps of middle school boys, so ages 11 through 14.
Okay.
But all of them lost their dads to military service.
Wow.
And the idea is to teach them in the outdoors skills and things about character that their dads would have taught them. And then maintain that friendship and relationship thereafter for the years to come until they leave the house. And so we're talking to these boys every week, every other week, and then we do a monthly Zoom all together from all, there's 10, we call them uncles,
mm-hmm.
but 10 mentors and 10 boys. It's 1-to-1 ratio.
Wow, that's really cool.
At these summer camps. And Brian, it's crazy, how hurt these kids are.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of them don't have any closure to the death of their dads. And some of them lost their dads when they were 8 months old.
Wow.
Where they never knew them, but they tell all these stories that they've heard. And other ones lost them 7 months ago, so or anything in between.
Yeah.
There's a lot of hurt there, and one of the things that we do, and this is the most powerful part of the week to me, is that we give them closure in that, and we line up the boys and they stand at attention, and all the uncles, the mentors, we march in military formation. And we stand at attention, and we honor their dads. And do you mind if I just read the script?
Because
I think it's pretty
great.
Powerful.
Yeah.
So we stand at attention, and we say, the reason you are at Life Camp is because you are not just anybody. You are special, not only to us, but to this nation. As mentors, some of us who are service members ourselves understand full well the sacrifice and cost of service. But nobody understands this sacrifice more than you all do. Tomorrow, you will be faced with the reality of heading back home without your fathers. For that, we are forever grateful. And because of you, we get to live free. So as you all depart Life Camp USA and embark on your individual journeys back at home, we want you all to know that your fathers are real life heroes. They all died honorably. And we are all standing here shoulder to shoulder to honor you and your father's sacrifice for all of us. We will now honor you and your fathers by saying their names and remembering their spirits, so their sacrifice will never be forgotten.
Wow.
Yeah.
As emotional as that hits me, I can't imagine being one of the boys there.
Brian, I mean, it's, you've probably gathered for some of the things that I've said, I'm not an emotional guy. I when I do this, I weep.
Yeah.
I can't stop. Like it's incredibly difficult. Mm-hmm. And I can't believe I didn't mention this, but the most important part of the camp is the whole reason we're doing this is to bring them to Christ.
Oh, is that right?
Yes.
Okay. Gotcha.
And we're teaching them biblical truths in conjunction with all these outdoor activities.
Wow.
And then we're singing worship songs around the campfire at night. And 80% of them got baptized last year.
No kidding. That's amazing. Wow.
And I think just amongst their suffering and being able to tie that to Jesus' suffering and talk to that, it's incredibly powerful.
Well, and I don't know if you guys get into this. I suspect you do, but specifically for young men and boys who have lost their dads, talking about the fatherhood of God, does that come up in the midst of the...
Yeah. Oh, yes. We talk about it a ton.
Do they ever have a chance to reflect back to you what you just read to us, what that experience meant to them? Do they have a chance to talk about what happened in their own hearts during that, or is there not kind of a forum for that sort of thing?
There is a forum. I think that... and I could be wrong about this, but the way that it feels is the emotions say all the words that we need to say. Like that, and that speaks for itself.
Yeah.
Where we never bring it up, they never bring it up, but I think it doesn't need to be said.
Yeah.
Because everything is said right here.
I'm guessing the boys, in some cases, maybe they just kind of stand strong and more stoically, but I'm guessing... For others, are kids breaking down in hearing these words and just...
Every one of them.
Yeah.
Every one of them. Yeah. And I've only done this for 2 summers, so it's been 20 boys, but every one of them.
Yeah.
Even the boy, there was one boy in particular that came in the camp. He lost his dad. It was 7 months prior. And he came in very bitter and not an emotional kid. And definitely from a troubled family.
Mm-hmm.
Even him, he... Yeah. I broke down.
Man, thanks for doing that, Kevin.
Yeah.
What a great example. And it strikes me that you guys are serving these kids out of an experience that, not that you've had directly, maybe some of the guys have been in their shoes, but you've been close to people. You've lost some of the guys, I'm sure, that are mentors, have lost friends or uncles have lost friends. Others just have a front row seat on what some of these boys are going through, or what they're all going through. And, you know, it's interesting hearing you talk about, hey, my experience of the past motivated me to give back to these boys in this way. I mean, really, that's a great picture of what the gospel should do for every one of us. You know, the reality is, when you see, for anybody who knows Christ, when you see the sacrifice that Jesus chose to give willingly, you know, filled with faith. But I mean, he was asking the Father in that last moment, hey, is there any other way? And he went through it. And when we experience that kind of sacrifice, it ought to change us such that we are instinctively, internally, we want to give back, like you guys are giving back to these boys. You've seen people sacrifice. Yep. And so I think on the one hand, I can sit here and say, thank you for that example, Kevin, and thanks for building into those boys. But I also feel like it's a real challenge to any of us who name the name of Jesus, because what you're doing for those boys is honestly what any of us who know Christ are supposed to be doing for anybody who is far from him.
Yeah.
And it's that experience of somebody who has given so much, watching that and motivating us to say, now, you know, how does that move me? Not out of guilt, not out of obligation, out of gratitude to give back. So I think that's a great picture of the gospel. I'm grateful for you sharing that with us. Anything else you want to share before we wrap up today? Anything else on your heart or mind?
No, I think that's it. Okay. Thanks, Brian.
Yeah, gotcha. I know we'll put this in the links, the show notes, but if we'll have a reference to your company.
Sounds good.
Do you do social media, or you probably don't, do you?
LinkedIn, but we're still, we have a lot of work to do on that front.
Okay, gotcha. So right now you're semi-incognito.
That's right.
Yeah. Although I read you guys' bios. I hadn't done a deep dive on your company until just the last couple of weeks. So it's fun to see the website and
yes.
see all the pages of what you guys are up to and whatnot. Yes. But Kevin, I've really appreciated conversations with you. Love that in the midst of your just exemplary service and sacrifice, I love your candor on, hey, it's I want to give back, but there's also some other motives that get in the heart. This isn't all a pure thing. And I love your candor on saying, I want to increasingly do the right things for the right reasons.
Yes.
And I appreciate the fact that you're still just making such an intentional investment in your relationship with Jesus. I think that when we talk about authentic manhood, it's not just doing the so-called manly things. You know, I mean, I feel like for some guys, it's like manliness equals a hunt and a fish and I love football and all this. And hey, if that's your thing, that's great. Yeah. You know, God bless you. And if you're a musician or an artist, God bless you. But it's standing strong for the important things. It's a willingness to serve. Yes. It's being real about the inner journey. It's inviting others into that place. And you're living all those things out, and it's caring for your marriage and your kids. And I just know that's a massive part of your heart. So, so thanks for your great example. I know you're going to inspire a lot of folks who are listening today.
Thanks,
and
Brian.
Look forward to continued relationship.
Yes. Thanks, Brian.
Well, I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Kevin. And I know this is an obvious theme during the entirety of the conversation, but listen, Kevin's done some of the toughest, bravest, most courageous kinds of things you can imagine. And yet, my man is doing daily devotions. He's reading his Bible. He's praying. He's making time to connect with his wife. He's serving his kids well. And he's such a great dad. I love watching him interact with his kids. He's working hard, but he's also saying, I want to make plenty of time for community and relationships. And I want to get real in those relationships. I don't want it just to be a bunch of having a good time. Though he does that, it's also, hey, we're going to get real. We're going to talk about deep things of life and faith. And so I hope and pray this has been an encouragement to you. I don't know what your next step is, but I know God probably has a next step for you. And so the best thing you can do right now is say, I'm not just going to listen to another encouraging message. I'm going to take a next step. I'm going to take some action here in the way that the Lord might be prompting you to do so. Well, hey, if you have enjoyed this conversation, please do rate and review us. That helps so very much, and it's a great encouragement to our team. This has been a production of Engedi Church. We have more great conversations coming up. So until next time, just know you were made to advance.